You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to my guest, Jacob Engelsman. We talk about career change and family. Jacob has a job and a specialty that I find super interesting. You'll hear how curious and excited I am about this in our conversation. He is a lactation consultant. So I don't have any statistics or data or charts on this, but it is my guess that there are not a lot of men probably working in the field of lactation, just a guess. And so I share that with him. I share it with you. We talk about how he found his way to this career, like how that worked out. I think you're going to love that story. But wait, there's more. Jacob specializes in supporting a very specific category of folks. And I'm going to let you listen to the interview, to the show, to hear all about that. So let's do it. Welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting, Jacob Engelsman. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I am. Thank you so much for having me.
You're so welcome. I start all of my conversations with each and every guest asking them what part of the world they call home. So where are you today?
Right now I live in Atlanta,
love
Georgia.
Love it. Home of horrible traffic, I hear, but I have bad traffic where I live too. So what is something that you love, not the traffic, or at least enjoy about the city or the town you call home?
So one thing that so answer to the question is the food.
Okay.
But an interesting thing that I just learned about the food in Atlanta is that, so we have some friends who just moved to Philly.
Okay.
And in Philadelphia, you can get something called, you can get chicken wings that are Atlanta style.
Oh.
And I did not know what Atlanta style meant. In my mind, my immediate assumption was that the wings were smoked, because that's a big thing here. Atlanta style wings up north is lemon pepper, which is also a big Atlanta thing.
Oh, all right. That is, I mean, it is a funny thing how we have the regional food that doesn't always match with what the region actually is. One of my favorite things about that I've learned in the last couple of years is Detroit style pizza, which several of my friends who grew up in New York or in Detroit were like, that's not actually a thing. That's only like a, that's only a marketing technique. I was like, well, it's delicious. It's delicious either way. So I don't actually know, but I really did enjoy it. All right, today we're not talking about pizza or, you know, wings, although delicious. We're talking about a time in your life where you moved and you changed careers. And I am openly going to admit that one of the reasons I selected this topic to have you on the show is that when you described what you do for your new career, it's something that I was curious about. I'm very excited for this conversation. Are you ready to talk to me about all this stuff?
Yeah, happily. Love to talk about it.
How long ago was it that you moved, you and your family moved to Atlanta?
9 years.
Oh, so quite a while. You've been there. You've settled in.
Yeah. We moved here. We just moved here from Athens, which is about 45 minutes away. Before that, I've lived in New Jersey, Kentucky, North Carolina, Iowa, California, and now Georgia. So we've been kind of all over. But we were in Iowa, my husband getting his graduate degree, his master's. And then we wanted to move back to the South. He's a librarian. He got a job at UGA in Athens. So we lived there for a few years. Then we wanted to move to like a proper city, but stay in the South. So now he's at a university in Atlanta. And yeah, so because and I don't know, are we intentionally burying the lead here on what
no,
my job
we're gonna get right to it. We're totally going to get right to it. But yeah, what inspired the move? So that's what you were talking about. That was my next question. So when you said Athens, I was racking my brain. So that's a school town. So you guys were bouncing around doing some. So you were in Iowa for school, graduate school. You moved to Athens, where I have been because of the school connection many, many decades ago when I was also a student. You guys wanted to be in a city. And then, yeah, tell us a little bit about, and you, what job were you doing? What career sort of service were you in before you guys were, when you came to Atlanta, I guess?
Yeah, so I'd been in food service since I was 15, and I got a job at McDonald's.
Okay.
And that's the thing. It's when you can cook, like if you're good at it, like I enjoy doing it. It was fine. And there's lots of different things you can do when you're working in food, right? I was a baker for a while. I was a kid. I was in management for a while. I was a line cook. I was a prep cook. There's all sorts of fun different things you can do. And if you're good at it, you can get a job anywhere. So if we're moving around a lot, right,
Yeah.
I can just go from restaurant to restaurant.
The hours are tough.
The hours can be tough. Sometimes the hours are great, though. Best job I ever had to this day. I was a pastry chef in fine dining. I worked from 6 until about 2, 6 in the morning. But I didn't see another human being for the entire first half of my shift. I'd get there. The kitchen was empty. I could
Very nice.
just take over and do everything I needed to do.
Oh, because it was like a
That's,
dinner service. You were creating
yeah.
pastries for the dinner. Because the opposite is if you're like, if you want to be a bagel maker or a donut maker, that's like 2 a.m. to
Oh,
10 in the
yeah.
morning, right? That's like a rough shift, like time to make
Now
the
this was
donuts.
making all the cakes and everything for dinner. And no, that's the thing. It's when people who haven't worked in restaurants think of restaurants, like line cooking.
Yeah.
I don't do that. I have done that, and I am very bad at that. I am not good at that at all. I get very frustrated. I get very yelly.
I can see it. All right, so you come to Atlanta because you wanted to be in a city, and then so yeah, I'm going to ask you to share a teeny tiny bit about your family as much as you're comfortable doing, because we're just meeting you and I today for the first time, and you're meeting the audience for the first time. So tell us a little bit about your family. You mentioned that you have a husband, so like, and you guys live in Atlanta. Like, go from there.
Yeah, no, and it's yeah, so he works in university, and just like being in academia, he's very specific about the places he can work.
Yeah.
So when we moved to Atlanta, and it's just us. We don't have kids. We have,
That was what I, so that is
yes.
because leading into, I have not gotten to what you do now, but
Yes.
I like had, you and I just had not talked, and I know what your new job is, and I was like, all right, so are there kids? Are there family? Like, how did we get there?
No, we are committed uncles.
Okay, committed uncles, there we go. Very
lots of
good.
nieces and nephews. We are committed uncles. Yes, so when we moved to Atlanta, he got his new job and kind of decided that like I've been in food service, for 20 years at that point. Not 20, but nearly 20 years at that point. And was just kind of done with that. I wanted to explore something new. And there were two things that I knew, which is that on the one hand, I'm really good with kids, and I really like taking care of young children and particularly infants. My mom, like even when I was a little kid, my mom always used to say that I had baby magic, right?
Okay.
Like there's a crying baby, give it to Jacob, and like I'm just good with babies, right?
Did you have lots of cousins, like nieces and nephews and cousins?
Yes,
Yeah.
yes,
I feel like
yeah,
the
my.
baby skill sometimes comes to people in big families because they're
Yeah.
around babies.
It's only me and my sister, but like my mom is one of nine, so I have tons of aunts and
There,
uncles.
yeah.
I've got tons of so yeah, I've got tons of cousins on both sides of my family. And then right, so I knew that A, I really like babies, and B, I'm not trying to go to med school, right? I don't want to
Okay.
be a pediatrician.
Fair
So I
enough.
looked up what I kind of like sat down and considered what would be the ideal job for Jacob. And I figured out like what the word for that job was. And what I came up with was postpartum doula, which is for listeners who don't know, a doula. So there's birth doulas and there's postpartum doulas, and they're not medical professionals, but they are people who have training in like helping you through pregnancy and delivery and the postpartum period, mostly from like an emotional point of view. And I absolutely know that there's going to be a doula listening to this who's going to be like, well, actually, like there's more to it than that. This is the abridged
And
version.
they're using, I don't know where I had not heard the word doula until like I don't think I knew that word as a kid. I don't know how long it's been around, but there's also they're using it in, I think, new ways. So the first type of doula I'd heard of was the delivery doula that you're talking about, somebody who's like, and these are my words and it's not my expertise, but you would bring them on as a part of your team. They sort of like will advocate for you and help you walk through the process. But I've talked to several people over the last couple of years who are doing things like death doula. So using the same word, but in a different situation. So I don't know if this is an old word that we're updating or if it's a new word that we're, repositioning. I really don't know. So.
Yeah, it's being used in a lot of different contexts to mean like somebody who's helping people through transitions.
So you picked this very intentionally. And take doula trainings. And what did you do this training in person? Was it like you went and like in person course or was it online?
No, it was an in-person course. And it was fine. I mean, I feel like I kind of learned a lot about the process and about like the community. Atlanta has a huge birth worker community. So after I did that training, I was reaching out to a bunch of other Atlanta doulas. And so I just Googled like Atlanta doula, and then I just had coffee and lunch with a million different people. And I met one woman who owned a doula agency who was pregnant. And we got to be friends. And she asked me if I would be her birth doula. And I was like, yes, but you know I haven't done a birth doula training. And she's like, you've got 6 months.
Okay.
So I did a birth doula training and I attended her birth. And I never got certified. Hers is actually the only birth I attended. I realized like being part of this whole community and learning more about the job that being a doula is not actually what I wanted to do, because being a
Okay.
doula is more like taking care. It's more like parent care than child care.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was going to ask you like so like is you had, like what was the dream? And so this is sort of the misalignment. I do have a question about you going through the training. I'm going to absolutely gender this in a super old-fashioned way just because it's the easiest way to have the conversation. So I would if you had said to me, Amy, have you ever met any men that are birth doulas? I would have said no. Like I think so when you were going through this training, were you the only like male gendered person in the room? Like, tell me a little bit about this.
And that's the thing, is working like in my field now, like I am often the only guy in a room.
Okay. Yeah, no, I mean,
So during like all of my trainings, I'm the only guy in the room. Or there's like one other guy in the room and he's a pediatrician. That's a thing about
Okay.
my position now, is a lot of people assume I'm a doctor.
Because which is just a statement on a co-ed room that they would make that immediate assumption, like the one guy in the room has to be
The
the one with
only,
the, not that you're not deserving of the thing, but as a woman who like, has grown up with that sort of, walk into a room and the person with the clipboard is the person in charge. That's not as surprising as it could be. So yeah, that does not surprise me. I mean, were you expecting that? Were you ready for that when you chose to go down this path of training, or was it an issue ever in the community and the sort of as a professional sense?
Yeah, I'm not too surprised by it, but also I am a person who, like, I have always been more comfortable hanging out with women.
Okay.
And I, couldn't, like, necessarily say why. My parents are a man and a woman and have a happy marriage. But yeah, so it's not like I didn't have male role models, but I don't know. I've just always been, most of my friends have always been women.
Most of the audience of this show is women, so and I'm a cisgender woman, like, so that's how I move through the world. So the dream, describe then before you started. So before you started the first training for postpartum doula, and you had really thought about it and were intentional about choosing this job description and the training, what did you tell us a little bit more about what you thought the job was going to look like that it turned out was not a perfect match?
I thought it was more like taking care of the baby and less like taking care of the parents so they can take care of the baby, right? Postpartum doulas do a lot of like meal planning and cooking and cleaning and taking care of the house and helping out around there, organizing, helping the parents organize their life around having this new tiny human.
Got it, got it. As opposed to like a baby nurse that's a nighttime nurse who's holding the baby and rocking the baby while
As
people
opposed to
sleep.
somebody who's holding
I
the baby
get it,
and
I
playing
get
with
it.
the
Yeah, and that's what you were wanting, more hands-on time with the
Right, right,
babies, which
right.
is your special sauce. All right, so you get connected. I think that's brilliant that you look people up and you do coffees with all the people that are in this field. You meet somebody, you experience we take part in one birthing doula, decide immediately that's not your gig. Somewhere in here, walk me through, you get a job at a lactation clinic.
Yeah, so then I found out that there was a lactation clinic called Breastfeed Atlanta where, like, while I was talking to everybody, one of the doulas in Atlanta was like, "Oh, you should talk to Christy. She runs this clinic. She's great." So I was like, okay, so call up Christy, hang out with her. She asks if I want to be her secretary. So my job is not, taking care of babies at all. My job is scheduling consultations, organizing breast pump rentals, and filing insurance claims, all of which are important skills.
Still not playing with the babies, though.
But what it did was it got me in the, like, A, I'm in the Atlanta birth worker community. And B, I'm in touch with families. I'm seeing families who just had new babies who might, need need childcare, need a nanny at some point. So I did, and so I was doing that part time and I was nannying part time, which is actually what I really wanted to be doing. And that's really my day job now is I do a lot of nannying.
Oh, all right. Very interesting. Okay, so that I can see how that worked out. So first of all, I just want to say, so I'm in Miami, Florida. That's my hometown. I am thrilled to even find out that there is a lactation clinic in Atlanta. I don't know if we have one here in Miami because a couple decades ago, when I was a first-time mom trying to figure out this whole thing, I was really kind of chasing down lactation consultants in, like, baby massage classes and wherever they were doing their workshops and hospital programs and stuff like that, but not a sticks and bricks like location, like this is where we go and we take care of it. And I'm thankful for all the resources I found, right? For sure. And so that is very, so you're in this clinic. In all of that experience, where this goes back to that sort of theme that I introduced with the training, in all of my chasing down lactation folks and being in lactation spaces, I never met anybody named Jacob or that present. There was no male secretary at the door, anything. This was like the red room of womanhood, like nurses and mommies. The only he hims were wearing diapers in the room. And so like I'm curious how did you get involved? How did you fit in with the lactation community? How did it feel like? Tell me how that worked out.
Good. So I have a question for you.
Yes.
Can I curse on this show?
You sure can. What's the reason
Okay.
for not like for having your own production company if you don't
Right.
get to make the rules, right?
So the reason I asked is because when we were initially talking about me having a job at the clinic, Christy was like, "Yeah, I feel like it would just be feminist as fuck for a lactation clinic to have a male secretary."
I mean, yeah, absolutely. With the, with the, because yeah, I totally see that. I mean, it could also be like, people would be like, am I in the right spot? Like, who is this guy? My first experience with like somebody helping me with lactation was like in the hospital with like a nurse who like manhandled me and the baby like into place. And you can like nurse is not always a woman, but in this case it was. But it's like, it's like I it is sometimes I think it's a fascinating part of this that you have leaned that you have found and created a network and a job in such a crazily girl dominated space.
Yeah. So when I was working in the clinic, after about like 6 months, Christy was like, "You should just get your certification," because the certification to become a lactation consultant is not, it takes about 3 years, I think, for most people. There's like 14 different college credits you need, and then like 90 hours of lactation specific education, which there are different sources to go through, and then 500 clinical hours, which I didn't realize
Wow.
at the time. For most people, the clinical hours are the hard part. I was already working in a clinic.
But that's a
So.
lot of hours. 500 clinical hours is, I mean, if you were to do, if you were to do 40 hours of full-time logging a week, I mean, it's a quarter, but probably how long did it take you to rack all that up?
Couple years, and we
Yeah.
would, we'd go through parts where like I'd work there full time or I'd work there part time because I had another gig or, but yeah, like all told, I worked there for a couple of years, and then there's a test that you take, which I my cohort to take that test, they only do it twice a year, was the first, it was during lockdown.
Okay.
And so we were the first people to take the test online because it used to, like, you take, there are specific testing sites.
Sure.
So we were the first people to take it online. And that was a thing about lockdown, actually, which is like weirdly beneficial to the lactation community, is we learned that a lot of lactation support can be done telehealth, right? Like, unless
Yes.
there's something specifically wrong with the parent's like chest tissue or with the baby's oral anatomy, right?
Yeah.
Then most lactation support can be telehealth. And before that, when I was doing my clinical hours, if a person couldn't come into the clinic, we went to them. Like telehealth was extremely rare until like one day we all figured it out.
Which is, I mean, that is the overall, in my opinion, hidden blessing of lockdown that we did take these things. Because when you are lugging around a 6-day-old baby trying to figure out if they're, if they're actually eating, from this system, that is a project. Nobody feels good. Nobody is having a good time in that trip.
Right, right.
And so if somebody had offered to, actually, that's an interesting question. If somebody offered to do telehealth the first time I was reaching out, I don't know, because I needed them to like, they needed to coach me through my confidence of like, this kid is, We're talking, 3 ounces of, I couldn't tell, the diapers were wet, nothing. I needed somebody to really bolster my confidence that the baby was not starving. And so I was happy to make the trip, but I'm happy for telehealth. It also, though, when I asked, did you do it in person or remotely, being able to train people remotely really opened up education and connection from between and to what we now call marginalized groups, people who would have not participated if they had to come in person or they were out of town or whatever. So, but you did do this training in person, and I give you a gold star because I love the visual of my mind of you walking into the very first postpartum doula class, like a room full of women, like, "Hi, my name's Jacob, and I want to be a doula." I think that would be great. Okay, so you go through this, you're doing clinical hours, you're also being a nanny. So this is like you are enmeshed in this family starting sort of period of people's lives. You come into the birth worker community in Atlanta. You eventually come to a spot where you begin to specialize with a very unique group. That's probably a very not the best word to choose, of people who need support in lactation. Tell us about how that came about.
So when I was doing my lactation education, so like I said, we need 90 hours of lactation specific education. I got mine through an organization called Childbirth International. But then also, like I was reading all these books for lactation consultants, and there's like two medical journals for lactation consultants, so I'm getting like really into the nitty-gritty of this field. And it dawned on me that there's all of this information that would be that's super relevant and would be super helpful for queer and trans families that is like not really being presented in a way like for families, right? It's all in the stuff for lactation consultants. But B, like even in the books about lactation and childbirth, it's not for queer and trans families. It's for every book is assuming that the person reading it is a cis woman who just gave birth.
Is right. I represent the standard person 100%.
Which 99% of the time is true, but there's still thousands of people, right, who for whom this information is super relevant, and it's not accessible, or it's not being presented in a way that is appealing to these communities.
100%, 100%. So, all right. So you discover that. So you are married to a man. So you are part of the queer community to start. But you discover you guys you're not. You guys are not. You guys didn't discover this through personal experience. Something happening inside your house. You sort of came to this conclusion, or awareness by reading the materials and just general knowledge of the world.
And I was like, this is a like there is a book that needs to exist that does not exist, right? Like this book that is lactation information written for trans guys and non-binary people who are pregnant or want to be pregnant and have questions, trans women and cis women who want to induce lactation because their wife is giving birth. Like this is a book that should exist that does not exist. But of course, at this time, I'm still like, I'm not even certified yet. So I'm like, this is a book that should exist, does not exist, and I have no business writing a book on lactation.
So that's so funny. It's like
So then I'm
somebody
like,
should write this book. It
if
shouldn't be
in
me.
5 years this book does not exist yet, I'm going to write it.
Oh, very interesting. All right, so I'm gonna so this is when I read your description of what you did and your specialty, I was like, I totally want to have this conversation because And I want to watch because I was just, it's something I've been reading about. It is like a loose part of like inducing lactation. Well, let's back up. It, before you have kids, it like this whole lactation thing seems like it's like, you know, ready, set, go, and it's easy for everybody. And the reality is that for modern women who do not spend a lot of time around families and aunts and uncles, it, for many, many people and who are going through the process, I shouldn't have said women, I should have said people who are going through this process, it's a daunting, unfamiliar sort of process to get the baby to eat, to make it work. I had a pretty easy experience overall, and I thought it was hard. I only know that mine was easy compared to like the hardships that other people go through. And I start this whole process like being like, yay, breastfeeding and lactation, but also just like babies need to eat. Like, I'm really open about all of that sort of thing as a concept. But they do touch on the books that I read. There is this awareness that you that lactation is not actually always directly attached to growing a human being inside your body. And like, but I've never met anybody or had the chance to talk to anybody who has actual experience in it. It's just like a little paragraph in a book. That's it.
Right, yes.
And so I want to talk, let's walk the through the audience who's like, what are you talking about, Amy? Like, what is the biology here, right? So all human mammals are born with mammary glands, is my understanding,
Yes.
right? Like, we all have them. Then if you are a human who grows a new baby inside your body, a little newborn, the idea is that this process, the hormones, usually kick off and you are able to feed the baby through lactation. Sometimes it's more complicated than that. It doesn't work for everybody. And that's when lactation consultants come in. But sometimes people want to kick this off when they have not grown a baby in their body. And this is something that you have actually worked with people, and you specialize with the queer community, but the other community that I've heard of that wants to do this sometimes is adoption when they're
Yes.
adopting.
So many people I've talked to
Yeah.
about inducing lactation are like, I wish I knew that was an option when I adopted my child, you know,
Yeah.
however many years ago. Yeah, well, and that's the thing that I don't want to change the subject, but I do just want to mention this. Basically, everything I talk about, like in reference to queer and trans communities, also applies to cis communities, right?
Right.
Like most mastectomies are cis women, not just trans guys having top surgery, you know?
Right.
Like
Right.
lots of cis women are on hormone treatments.
Yes.
Like,
No, everybody over the age of 50. Yes.
so like, right? And women over the age of 50 can induce lactation if they really want to.
So yeah, so let's so there's all right. So this is your special you do specialize with queer families, and let's talk about like so the idea is that as someone who is a doula and a lactation consultant, you're helping families and a community of people who are really marginalized is an excellent word for this because they're outside the standard, you know, concept in the books and on the, you know, ads in Target for, you know, what newborn shopping looks like. And you're helping them in give us some examples of when this how this works.
So, most of the time, when somebody wants to induce lactation, they. So, most of the people that I'm talking to have a spouse who's pregnant or a
Okay.
partner. And so they know when the baby's coming, right?
Okay.
Their partner just got pregnant. They have a due date and they want to induce lactation so they can also, you know, take part in that experience.
So this is a family where you would have two, they're hoping that they'll have two parents who are able to breastfeed.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Wow, that would be helpful, actually. Yes. Having been in a house where only one person was able to breastfeed, having someone to pass off to, yes.
It does mean that both parents will need to do some pumping, right, in order to
Okay.
like maintain a full supply. But yeah, there are pros and cons to it. But yeah, for some families, it's really important that both parents share in this. And so in those cases, when you have a baby coming, when you know the date for the baby, Or, for example, if there's like a surrogate or an open adoption,
Oh,
something like
sure, a
that,
surrogate. Another opportunity. Yes. Okay. Just I didn't think about
then
that.
usually what parents will do is they will. Step one is to try to trick your body into thinking you're pregnant. So usually that means taking birth control pills,
Okay.
skipping the placebo week, and not for the entire time, right? Usually just for like 3 or 4 months. And then, so you try to trick your body into thinking you're pregnant, and then convince your body you have a hungry baby.
Okay.
So you take birth control pills for 3 or 4 months, and then stop taking them and immediately start pumping.
And it's the pumping that mimics what the baby would do,
And yes,
right?
pumping is the most important part. People, you know, because a lot of people want to do this, but they don't want to take any pills or, take any medications, which is fine. But yes, pumping is the most important part. So I've had people say to me like, "Oh, I can't induce lactation because I had a hysterectomy." And I'm like, that is fully irrelevant to lactating. Like the presence of a uterus, the presence of ovaries does not matter at all in the context of lactation.
I think for a lot of people who may never have thought about it or had like a late night conversation about it, that that's kind of a bombshell piece of information. Because I think that most people tie it directly to those organs.
But no, and so with that in mind, trans women can also induce lactation. In theory, cis guys can. You don't hear about it a lot, mostly just because I feel like there's not a lot of overlap of like cis guys who want to. But yeah, I always phrase it as in theory, cis guys can.
Yeah, I mean that's the late night like theoretical conversation. You've had too many drinks and you're talking about this with your friends is that, if a cis man was in a forest and found a newborn, like that in theory they could develop and feed the baby. I don't know if there's ever been a case of it. But yeah, like the biology is there. The mammary glands are present.
Yeah, and the hormones are not present in like the required amounts, but yeah, like in like emergency situations, like you were saying,
Yeah.
there's always that sort of possibility. And sorry, I've got an
You've got a
ambulance driving by.
siren. Yes.
And then with cis guys who are interested, because I've had a few contact me about, they're interested. I'm like, you're absolutely going to need to take hormones, right? Like,
Yeah.
and a lot of people too don't realize that if you have ever lactated in the past, you'll have an easier time of it.
Well, so one of the things that I had never thought about until it was like so is the old-fashioned concept of like so one of the things is right back in the old days like women would like there were wet nurses and there were people like so now we're very particular that like there's a relationship between the person who had the baby and feeds the baby. But I think in olden times, never lived there, don't actually know this to be true, but there were like wet nurses that were sort of lactating well past, like, because they didn't have any formula or anything like that. So you were either going to feed goat milk or, water, or there was somebody who was. So people, I think, were lactating for a lot longer time because it was kind of their job.
Wet nurse was like a full-on profession.
Right.
And
Like my
because
job
that's
is
the
to
thing.
feed babies.
Yeah, like as long as you are continually latching a baby and removing milk, the body will continue to make milk
As long as it's, yeah, no.
I mean, I want
So,
to say indefinitely, but like as a professional, now I'm like, how long could, like, could you just do it for 20 years?
I don't have
But
anyone here.
probably.
Right, like maybe. So let's talk about some of the, so we talked about some of the, because one of, you wrote this book. So you, 5 years go by.
Yeah.
No, you're doing all this certification. You told yourself, almost like a, that high school deal where it's like, if none of us are married by the time we're 30, we'll marry each other. You were like, in
Right.
5 years, if this book still isn't written, I'm going to write it. You do like 5 years go by and you're like,
Yeah.
shoot, nobody wrote it. Now I have to
So
write this book.
the whole time I'm kind of like outlining it and writing articles for magazines, right? So like I'm getting some writing experience, right? Getting some writing chops and developing a little bit of a little bit of a name in certain circles. And then after I got certified, I the book's still, there's been like one or two other books while I was researching mine, and I honestly can't even say if I learned about it before or after I got my book contract, but like a year or so before my book came out, another book called Feed the Baby by Victoria Ficelli came out. And it covers a lot of the same information. But that being said, like just because there's one book on the subject, I didn't feel the need to abandon this
Right.
project. So, and I actually interviewed Victoria for my book. She's a gem. And so, yeah, so while I was doing the research, I found a book called Supporting Queer Birth by AJ Silver. And I was like, okay, the people who publish this book are going to be the people who publish my book. Like
Yeah.
that's this is a one-to-one here. So yeah, so I sent my proposal out to Jessica Kingsley Publishers. And yeah, and the first people I sent my proposal to picked it up. Here's the thing that I didn't people I realized people don't know about writing a book is that if you want to publish a novel, you write a novel and then get it published. If you want to publish a nonfiction book, you write a sample chapter. So you don't have to write the whole book. So yeah, so I had a good sample chapter, you know, I had a good introduction, a good sample chapter, a good outline, a good solid table of contents idea, which of course by the time the book's actually published, everything's completely different.
As it
But good
goes.
enough to get the book contract.
Yeah.
And yeah, and I sent it to Jessica Kingsley, and they were like, yes, absolutely, we want to publish this book.
I mean, I think it's a really amazing thing because there's a lot of choices and decisions here that just sort of lined up. And it sounds to me as an outsider that, you know, you had a some good timing and awareness to say, hey, this is a part of the human community that is not being served well enough to lean into it and do the research and committed 5 years to wait to write a book and still be willing to do it. That's a long time. We've talked a little bit about it, but I'd love to get you give you a chance to talk about some examples of and the people who, you know, for the some of the people who are in these groups will already know, but it's important to name and claim like the people who can be supported by this book and by this project. Like not all families are heteronormative at all. So let's go through like some of the people you mentioned, trans men, which I think your word, you call it trans dudes. Is that the way you describe it?
I'm sorry.
You say, how do you say trans men or trans, like, so I think you said
Oh,
trans man, yes.
yeah, trans men in general, trans men, non-binary people.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of surprise in like cisgender heterosexual communities that trans guys do want to give birth. Like
Yeah.
that there is any overlap between people who identify as trans men and people who want to give birth. But it is not as uncommon as, you know, some people probably suppose. And That being said, these guys tend, tend to have a lot of questions and concerns about lactation, which most people who are getting pregnant do have a lot of questions and
I
concerns
did,
about
I
lactation.
did, yeah. So
But also, they want to talk to somebody who is going to recognize them as a guy.
yeah.
And also, there are very specific questions like, when can a lot of people are like, when can I start taking testosterone again? Because when you're
Okay.
pregnant, you have to stop taking testosterone. That is a point blank thing.
Oh, see, I would
But
never even, I've never, I've like, it's the thing, I've never even thought about it because it's not, yeah, but yes.
And there was a big assumption for a long time that testosterone was going to be antithetical to making milk, which it's really not.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
This is kind of an interesting thing where, so A, it was kind of assumed that testosterone would inhibit milk production, which sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. It seems to depend a lot on the person. But there was also an assumption that testosterone would get into the milk supply and be bad for the baby. Here's the thing about that. And this is like, these are based on case studies where people have had the lab work done, like done all the testing levels in the blood and the milk and everything. So here's the deal. So testosterone gets injected. Goes into the blood supply. Testosterone level, some of it does get into the milk. However, when the baby eats that milk, testosterone is not absorbed well by the stomach, which is why they use injections to begin with. So, when the baby gets that milk that does have a higher testosterone level, it does not lead to a higher testosterone level in the baby's blood. The baby just poops that testosterone
Oh, okay. So, because the way people take testosterone in most cases, intermuscular injection. Yeah. And I didn't know that that was even because, because it wasn't digested, but that makes sense. I think it's so when you were writing the book, and we'll wrap this up pretty soon. When you were writing the book, were you in a spot where you were able to find a lot of existing research? Or was it a lot of interviews and talking to people who were, figuring this out and working through it without writing, doing lab work and going public with it because there is small sample size.
So a little bit of both.
Okay.
Most of the research is small sample groups or case studies. So I was doing a lot of research in the journals, and it's funny, I actually said two. There's actually three journals on human lactation.
There you go.
There's Clinical Lactation, there's the Journal of Human Lactation, and the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine also has a journal on human
I
lactation.
love that. Never knew. Okay.
Yeah, right. Parents,
Yes, yeah.
right. Parents aren't reading the Journal of Human
It
Lactation.
was not, I read the, I had, I was a very nervous new mom, and I called my dad and I sent him to the bookstore to buy the Dr. Sears book on breastfeeding.
Yeah.
And that was my, other than, what to expect when you're expecting. And,
Yeah.
that was kind of it for me.
But then also, so I was at a conference. I was at a lactation conference when I first started writing this book, and one of the presentations was on supporting trans women who are inducing lactation by this
Okay.
speaker named Brynna Hayden. And as I'm watching this, I'm like, oh, I need to interview for them for this book. Like we need to collaborate on this chapter because like they know way more about this than I do.
So yeah, so trans men, trans women, and I would think like, so this is not anything I have experience with. The first time you ask somebody, though, I mean, it can be a very personal conversation to talk to a doctor about anything. But it's to open up the conversation and begin to think about family planning when you're not sure how the person on the other side of the conversation is going to receive you as a human being or feel about the situation. Like family planning in family planning is a complicated thing in anything, right? In any kind of family, but in queer families and queer communities, I think it's an extra layer of consideration, safety, and acceptance. And so, and I thought, I was wondering if that would fall over into the research on these topics. Like, how are we going to do this? Who are we going to talk to about it? Who knows about it? How public do we go with this information?
Yeah, there's a lot more of this research being published right now, but also there is a bit of pushback from lactation communities because this has historically been such a very specifically like feminine space
Yeah.
that that now, like other communities are, also wanting to be a part of it because they are also lactating people.
Yeah.
They want, they wanna be in on this. And I think one of the things that's important to stress in conversations like these is that, like, I'm not telling anybody to change their language about anything or to change the way they do anything, right? I'm asking people to like basically be nice, like if you
Yeah.
don't feel comfortable, if a lactation consultant doesn't feel comfortable working with trans communities, like that's fine. Like just know somebody who you can refer them to, right? Like
Such an important
that's
piece, yeah.
literally the bare minimum,
Yeah.
right? Just be like, because
And
that's the
also, though,
thing.
so important. It's like, you walk into a chicken restaurant and you don't want to eat chicken. You're like, hey, where can I find a hot dog stand? That's like really helpful. Really, really helpful. And on the other hand, what's not helpful is, and I used a goofy example because it is so ridiculous, happens all the time in medical services where you're like, hey, I have this problem, and the person on the other side is like, oh, yeah, that looks terrible. I don't do that. And that's the end of the conversation. And it's back on you to do the research to figure out, who can I find? So, the fact that you wrote this book, the fact that there are three books, the fact that you're helping people, that there's the chance that somebody would walk into a room and be like, hey, this is what's going on in my life, that somebody would be like, I know someone you can talk to.
Right. Well,
Yeah.
because that's the thing is if somebody contacts me with a lactation, they have a lactation support question, and it's because their baby has a cleft palate or something,
Yeah.
right? Like that is outside of my skill set. So I'm going to refer them to somebody else. It's not because I think there's anything wrong with babies with cleft palates, but it's
Right.
like that is a specialty that I am not suited to care for.
Yeah, that's
You
a, and
need to
that's
talk
a,
to this person.
right. No, that's yeah, no, absolutely. So tell us a little bit about, this has been a long project for you. You knew from your own experience that there were people who would benefit from this information or writing this book. Now, having published the book and it's been out there in the world, why do you feel that this topic and this book and the work that you do as a lactation consultant for queer families, in all of their different forms is important?
Why do I feel that it's important? Because we have historically just been like an underserved population. And it's not even sometimes, I mean, sometimes, yes, we've been a population underserved intentionally by different groups, but in this field, in this scenario, like it is just now coming to medical professionals' attention, right?
Right.
Like trans guys who want to give birth, like were extremely rare. Like I remember when I was younger, Thomas Beatty is like the first person who I think is legally considered a man who gave birth. And it was all over the news, right? His memoir was like a bestseller.
Yes, it's very modern, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, like it is kind of a new field. So, and I think that Yeah, we can't let this like fall by the wayside, I guess is a
I mean, I would agree with you. I bet you there are plenty of people who could take an opposite position, but I think that one of the great benefits of being alive in 2026, where information is at our fingertips and, information zaps around the world very, very quickly, is that we can do, hopefully, as a community, as a humanity, a better job of creating pockets of information for very specific subspecialties. Yeah, I think
Yeah.
that's, yeah.
I like that pockets of information.
Yeah, because I mean, this is something that you specialize with. I mean, do people reach out to you? Do people find you sort of from all over the world or just in Atlanta? For Nanny, probably just in Atlanta, but.
Oh, yeah, no, for lactation support, I almost exclusively do telehealth because most of the people contacting me are seeking information, right? They are
Yeah.
not people who currently have a hungry baby and are having.
Yeah.
And if they are, then I usually help them find a local lactation consultant who's going to be, accepting. But no, almost everybody that I talk to as a lactation consultant is somebody who either wants to be pregnant and also feels like, they want to have top surgery and they have questions about how to do that, or they're a cis woman or a trans woman and their wife is pregnant and they want to induce lactation. And then with the inducing lactation, I used to do like follow-up consultations every like couple of weeks. But then we realized that that is like largely unnecessary because once you get started with the pumping, like the follow-up consultation is like, how's it going? How much milk you making? You feeling all right? Like it can easily be an email.
I can totally see that. I can absolutely see that. All right. So,
So it became like consultations, like when you think that you actually have a problem, when it's just a
yeah.
question of like, you doing all right? Okay.
No, that's, and I think that, people who are, this is, a very, it's a very personal thing, but it's also very much in touch with your own body. And I think that the folks that are reaching out to you are very invested. And aware of their own physical body, and which is helpful for this. So, in a second, we're going to wrap this up, but let's tell people about the book. And I will put the link to the book on bookshop.org in the show notes wherever people are listening so they can find it there.
Thank you. Yeah, I just realized I haven't actually said the name of my book
Yeah,
yet.
let's do it.
So it is Lactation for the Rest of Us, a guide for queer and trans parents and helpers. It came out February 2025, so almost a year ago now, from Jessica Kingsley Publishers. I am currently working on, I'm thinking of it as like a follow-up book. Called Baby Wrangling for the Rest of Us,
Okay.
which about like a book about infant care, but that's written in kind of the same way as it's not going to assume the gender or sexuality of the parents at all. I do not have a contract for that one yet, so if I have any publishers or agents in the audience, please reach out.
100%. No, there are definitely some small imprint publishers who've been on the show who will be hearing this and all of those things. All right, so Lactation for the Rest of Us. I love this interview and I love this story. All right, are you ready for the wrap-up questions, the fun wrap-up questions?
Yeah, absolutely. Hit
All
me.
right, let's do it. What is one way that you find and make new friends or community in 2026? It's brand new 2026, so you could think about
Right,
2025.
So my husband and I play a lot of games. We're big board game people,
Okay.
big role-playing game people.
I was gonna see the follow-up question. Is it, do you mean Scrabble or do you mean like the more
No,
complicated?
Dungeons and Dragons people.
Oh, very nice. I just watched with my college age kids the finale of Stranger Things. I hadn't watched any of the original. I didn't realize it was based around a Dungeons and Dragons story.
We
So.
I watched like the first two seasons of the, and then I don't know, kind of petered out.
Well, we might be the part I didn't watch any of it. We might be a little old, you and I, for it, to tell you the truth. But I did very much enjoy that Winona Ryder is one of the adults in the story, and so it's supposed to be happening in the 80s. So I was having in the hour and a half that I watched, like with my kids, I was like having like nostalgia moments from like Heathers and all of the other fun things. So
Heathers.
yeah, exactly. And what was the one where she was on the TV things? Is that Reality Bites? Is that the name of the movie, or is that something else?
Reality
So
Bites was a show.
Reality Bites is a show. What was the one where she wants to be in the videographer? She has like an existential crisis as like a new college grad.
I do not know.
Okay, all right. So that was anyway. That was that. So very good. So gaming. Do you guys host game nights?
Yeah, we and that's another thing that we learned you can do online during
Oh,
lockdown.
really?
Yeah, just Zoom. We just Zoom what's the word? Conferences. And
I had no idea. Of course, that would work. If everybody has to have their own pieces, I tried to get my family to do. They were like, "What do you want for the holidays?" I was like, "I want Family Catan," and they were like, "No, rejected."
what? No, that's the
No, they
greatest
don't.
game.
Yeah, I have an equal split. Like half the family likes to play games, and the other family is like it's torture for them. So we don't always do it. All right. Do you read and or listen to books? And if so, can you share the last book you read or listened to that you liked?
Yeah, so I'm a big reader. I listen to podcasts, I read books. But one of my little like things that I do on the side is I review horror novels for a website
Okay.
called Malevolent Dark. So I just read a book by hold on one second. She has two last names, so I want to make
I'm making
sure
sure
I
she did it
get them
right.
in the right order. Okay. I just read a book by Gretchen Felker Martin
Okay.
called Black Flame about like a haunted. It's about a movie that was made like pre like right before World War II, and like all of the copies of it were destroyed, but then this film restorer gets a copy and starts restoring it, and like spooky horror novel stuff starts
Okay.
happening. Yeah, so that was a
Very
really good
good.
one. I wildly oversimplified that plot. If
Well,
she's listening to
I
this,
only
I'm sure
gave you like a
she's
second.
furious, but
Well, let's hope she's
yes.
happy for like,
And she has two other novels out that are equally great, Cuckoo and Manhunt. So yeah, if you're a fan of horror novels, Gretchen Felker Martin.
So not exactly a horror, but I was having a conversation with one of my other kids because apparently there's a remake of War of the Worlds on TV with Ice
I've
Cube
heard about
as the
that.
character.
Yes, I heard about that.
And so then I said, well, that's really interesting. I said, do you know the original story of the radio program War of the Worlds? And this conversation required a history lesson about radio programs pre-TV for this very young audience. And then I like read them the Wikipedia thing about how there were some people who would listen to the radio show who thought there were actual Martians coming to there, which is a super funny thing that could happen. But then again, I fall for AI stuff all the time, so it could happen today.
Right? Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, oh, those unsophisticated people in the 30s, and it's like, no, dude, like you totally would have fallen for
Oh,
that.
100%. I tell people all the
Absolutely.
time, I'm like, I think I'm very savvy, but I was obsessed with like the grandma. I thought she was feeding like she had domesticated a bear and she was like feeding the bear. And then somebody's like, that's fake. And I was like, what? And then I thought about it and I was like, of course it's fake. Of course that's fake. But I just really wanted it to be like a real thing. All right, last one. Are you a morning person or a night owl?
I like the idea of being a night owl, But because I have to get up at like 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the mornings, I'm kind of forced into being a morning person.
And is that because you've got small clients who are early morning risers for the
Yeah,
families? Yeah.
so just yeah, 'cause I've got like a 45-minute or an hour commute, and job starts at 8, and so I like spiritually I'm a night owl, but I'm forced into being a morning
That's
person.
right. So I'm very much a morning person, and I have no idea whether or not that's because I just always would have been that way, or because it was beaten into me by the rigor of like getting up early for years and years. I just have no idea, but it stuck, and that's just that I've accepted it about myself, and I'm like, that's great. This
I
is
feel like
who I
if
am.
I feel like if I could write full time, I would absolutely be up until 3 a.m. writing
Yes,
every night.
that is the persona of the writer, like, writing off into the middle of the night. All right, that's it. Jacob Engsman, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adultier adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.